Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Nice to see such a big turnout on a Friday afternoon. And it's a great pleasure for me to welcome Peter Mandelson, the Trade Commissioner, to the school. I was recalling that I think we first met, Peter, about 20 years ago when I was working in the Treasury for Nigel Lawson. And Peter was at that time working as a researcher for Weekend World. And for some reason, it was deemed that I was the appropriate person to attempt to persuade Peter Mandelson of the correctness of the government's economic policies at the time. I remember it, I think the pound had just sunk to $1.04 on the day he came in, and I don't think I made a huge amount of impression. But I did remember the fact that he had very acute questions. And also at the time, a slightly sinister and rather menacing moustache. But all that is behind him. He and I have come across each other in, I hope, a generally friendly way as our careers have crisscrossed over the last 2 decades. I think he needs little introduction to this audience. That's usually a prelude to someone reading out a complete CV from primary school onwards. I won't do that. Peter has been in and out of this Blair government for reasons I can't now recall. And was...
None of them were justified.
And, of course, was appointed last year to Brussels, to one of the most important jobs in the European Commission. Which is, of course, an ideal spot for someone who has long been a very committed British European. We are greatly looking forward to what he has to say. I think this is one of the very first, if not the first, significant policy statements since he's been in the job of Trade Commissioner. And there are few issues more important than the future of the European Union's trade policy. Over to you, Peter.
Well, Howard, thank you very much indeed for that introduction. I'd forgotten about Weekend World. I'm glad my salary proportionately has now gone back to where it started when I worked for commercial television before I went into politics. Since you mentioned Friday in this late hour on a Friday, can I say how grateful I am to everyone for turning up. I didn't say turning up to listen to my speech. That might be too much. Roy Jenkins always said of lectures that they're more boring than a speech and longer. I shall do my best to prove him wrong. Roy Jenkins, incidentally, who now sits in his portrait form on my wall in my office in the Berlin Mall, along with Jacques Delors. Now, this evening I want to deliver a lecture and not a sermon, but on this subject, sermons and prophets, I think, have an important place. The appalling conditions under which many hundreds of millions of our fellow human beings live poses a grave moral challenge to our sense of common humanity. There's still a place for prophets of our time who use truth to stand up to power, who prick complacency with conscience, and who expose the hypocrisy of the comfortable and the self-interested. And I say that consciously in the context of trade and development. I pay tribute to those modern prophets, Bob Geldof, Bono, the stars who campaign to make poverty history, but also the ordinary people who often write to me from largely, not always, but largely religious communities up and down the country with their personal plea for something to be done about the world's poor. And in a quiet and unassuming way, do something themselves. But I'm not a prophet, I am the European Commissioner for Trade and External Competitiveness, to be precise. I do have a moral commitment, however, on this subject, dating from the year I spent in the early 1970s in Tanzania, in northern Tanzania, working first of all on a farm, and then on the Burundi-Rwanda borders in a hospital, and then in a primary school. But my current job is very practically to try and get things done. And my ambition is to help make 2005 a breakthrough year for the world's poor, the year when we use the combined negotiating power of the European Union to put trade at the service of development. 2005, it is becoming clear, is a once-in-a-generation chance for the poor in this world. In part, this is a lucky coincidence of events. Britain's G8 presidency, with its clear focus on Africa and climate change, the UN review of the world's feeble progress towards the UN Millennium Development Goals, and the WTO's Hong Kong ministerial meeting in December, which is the crucial staging post of the Doha development round. But it is more than a lucky coincidence of events. One can feel in the air a gathering of international political will. The shock of the tsunami still reverberates around the world. Through it, our eyes were opened to the fragility of the human existence of millions of people. It has made us more conscious, not less, of the daily tsunamis that destroy life in our world. The 3,000 children a day who die in Africa as a result of malaria. The 6,000 people a day who die from HIV and AIDS. These daily tsunamis are stoppable within a few short years, if only together the world community can gather the will to act. Every so often in the past, hopes of action have been raised only for the follow-through to disappoint. The attention of the richer nations has been distracted by international tensions and economic crises or whatever. The response of the poor has too often been dissipated in corruption, bad governance, and civil war. In 2005, the task of political leadership is to seize the moment. Today's meeting of the G7 finance ministers is an important milestone in mobilizing aid and tackling debt, and I wish it every success. But trade is the third leg of this development triad. Actions on trade, aid, and debt need to complement each other. But how? To note that there is a fortunate coincidence of events, even a gathering convergence of political wills, does not mean that there is yet a coordinated plan of action. And my purpose this evening is to set out what, in my view, the elements of this plan of action should be. Of course, trade is about more than development. Indeed, until the Uruguay round in the 1990s, it was seen as largely separate from development. It was basically about dismantling the walls of protectionism erected in the interwar years that destroyed the pre-1914 model of globalization based on free trade and the gold standard. The establishment of the World Trade Organization was a notable culmination of decades of progress towards more open trade. It represented the acceptance by the industrialized world of a multilateral system of rules based order, including a unique international arbitration system for settling trade disputes, a remarkable step, given that the US Congress had been unwilling to ratify a similar proposal at the high point of US internationalism in the immediate post-war era, when the other Bretton Woods institutions were established. The WTO membership expanded in total from 90 to nearly 150 in a decade, of which three quarters are now developing countries. Yet most developing countries joined only to react in a short space of time against what they saw as the very biased rules of the club which they had joined. They latched on to the long-standing Cairns Group's campaign against agricultural protectionism, and I don't blame them for this. They criticised intellectual property rules, sometimes justifiably, that were seen to deny access to necessary medicines to treat the new scourge of HIV and AIDS. They rejected the concept of core labour standards that they attacked, wrongly in my view, as covert protectionism by developed countries. And they insisted on the withdrawal from the Doha Round of three of the so-called Singapore issues, designed to extend international rulemaking over an economic agenda of investment, competition, and public procurement. They misinterpreted Europe's enthusiasm for the Singapore issues as an attempt to deny developing countries the policy space to make their own domestic choices. And I think this was a pity. I would argue that developing countries, no less than developed countries, benefit from transparent procurement rules, a predictable climate for badly needed foreign investment, or effective competition authorities that level the playing field. But what is done, at least for the Doha Round. One of my biggest challenges as the EU's Trade Commissioner, negotiating as I do on behalf of the Union and its 25 member states, is to overcome these hesitations and doubts about the rules-based multilateral trading system. Fundamentally, the rules-based system of the WTO protects the economically weak against the strong and the powerful in our world. This must surely be better for the poor than the law of the jungle. So for that overriding reason, we must complete the Doha Development Round on a basis from which all gain some benefit, but which has as its driving purpose the promotion of sustainable development for developing countries so that they gain the most. And if we can recommit the developing world to the WTO system as core to their interests, then in future it will be possible to address with more objectivity the so-called trade and issues, which are also relevant to development. To summarise my approach in a simple soundbite, I am pro-growth in Europe and pro the poor in the world. I am on the side of growth in Europe because the renewal of growth is our only route to full employment, to social cohesion and long-term sustainability. That's why I'm such a strong supporter of what President Barroso and all of us in the college are doing and what we launched this week in the Lisbon Agenda Mark II. But also because a more prosperous Europe will be a more outward-looking and generous Europe, not least in its policies on aid and debt relief, which are already, it is worth reminding ourselves, the most generous of any region in the world, and of that we can be proud as Europeans. But how in practice should and can Europe's trade policies work to help the poor? Answering this question requires a model of how trade and aid can work together for successful development. A small historical digression illustrates my thinking and my own approach. And I'm afraid, incidentally, it's a British example, which perhaps reflects what used to be wrong with history teaching in our schools and ancient universities. But as for most British progressives, as I am, free trade instincts flow powerfully through my veins. But I also know enough, I think, about British economic history to understand that it wasn't free trade alone that made the Industrial Revolution a success. It was the can-do success of British, including Scottish, innovators in incrementally turning workshop inventions into productive machinery, the ready availability of capital and labour and an abundance of natural resources that led to the exploitation of first water power then coal, then iron. So open trade is not in itself a magic wand. Growth will only result if the opportunity to trade is combined with the necessary capacities and resources to participate in trade. And that means organisation of those capacities and those resources to harness them in the cause of development and economic growth. And here I want to question a current received wisdom, or at least argue it's not enough. For more than a decade, good governance has been seen as the decisive factor that has separated the sheep from the goats in terms of development. This is, of course, correct up to a point, but we must be careful of the extent to which it enables rich countries to absolve themselves of responsibility in defiance of the facts. Very poor countries will almost always, by definition, have weak public administrations. But a weak administration is not inevitably a hopeless administration. It need not be headed by a governing elite without public spirit, determined to enrich themselves at the expense of their own people. Not necessarily. In the last decade, there has been political reform in many African countries. There is a willingness to accept peer review and the principle of mutual responsibility. Where a country's governance offers hope, we should move heaven and earth to help and mobilize maximum support for it. We must demonstrate by example how success can breed success. Poor countries with good governance potential, and they do exist, need tangible help with capacity building. You cannot, for example, trade if you cannot get your goods to market at reasonable cost. Countries cannot trade without the necessary investment in infrastructure, nor can they thrive without a workforce with basic levels of education and health. In a poor country, much of that investment can only come from external aid, effectively used. It is unrealistic to think, for example, that it is possible to solve infrastructure problems by the private sector alone. Poor people simply lack the money to pay user charges. So, in addition to encouraging conditions that attract private investment, we need to design public-private partnerships so that developing countries can make use of private sector skills, while a key role is played by investment funded by overseas aid. The Sachs report for the UN estimates that, and I quote, in a typical low-income country with an average per capita income of $300 in 2005, external financing of public interventions will be required of the order of 10 to 20% of GNP. Aid is presently meeting a little over a quarter of these countries' funding needs if the development goals are to be met. For all these reasons, I very much hope that Gordon Brown is successful in persuading others to establish a new international financing facility that will enable money to be borrowed now against repayment of debt in the future. Clearly, however, if the money available for aid is not to be reduced in the years ahead by interest and debt repayments on the IFF bonds, then new sources of revenue for international development have to be found. Jacques Chirac raised this issue at Davos. It will need to be addressed, if not in the particular way he suggested. The Sachs report argues that developing countries themselves have a tendency to exaggerate the role that trade can play in solving their development problems. True for the very poorest countries, market access cannot in itself be enough. Many of those countries, especially the ACP countries, the African, Caribbean and Pacific countries, have enjoyed special preferences in European markets for decades. Yet these preferences have failed to raise the ACP share of EU trade. Quota regimes for special products, such as sugar and bananas, have been the lifeblood of several vulnerable economies, something that might be borne in mind by those making simplistic demands for European external trade barriers to be torn down. But the protectionist European market regimes that facilitated them by sheltering them from competition are nonetheless unsustainable. They have done a reasonable job for ACP and least developed countries by enabling preferences to continue. But they are now declining. They are now eroding. And we need to find new solutions to lift these countries out of desperate poverty. We have had the EU's own General System of Preferences, GSP, as well as the Lomé and Cotonou agreements with the ACP countries. The GSP is currently being revised to make it more favourable to developing countries like Bangladesh and Sri Lanka, and I hope that Member States and the European Parliament will accept my proposition, which they're now considering, to advance the introduction of our new system from the summer to Easter. As a result of WTO rulings, we are in the process of transforming our ACP relationships into regionally based economic partnership agreements with some of the world's poorest countries. Now, these partnership agreements, EPAs, are controversial with some, and I've heard the case issues raised about them by many NGOs. My firm belief is that they represent the best way forward for smaller, weak economies. By encouraging and actively supporting with aid and assistance a process of regional integration with their close neighbours, Europe can help set our ACP partners on a more successful growth path than they have experienced in the last three decades. But more of this later. 3 years ago, the European Union dramatically extended tariff and quota-free access for all LDCs with its Everything But Arms initiative. All LDC products, including all types of agriculture, will enter the EU entirely tariff and quota-free progressively over the next 5 years. So there is market access in Europe for the poor, perhaps not enough, but substantial nonetheless. The fundamental point is that without investment, though, in capacity building, the poorest cannot use the preferences they already have, let alone what further we propose and plan to do. Trade can, however, make a huge development contribution once the capacity to participate in the global trading system is established. A long intellectual debate has raged about whether countries that have pursued a strategic approach to trade, the Korean model, have been more successful in promoting economic development than those who have let market forces prevail, the Singapore model. Now, I am not a neoliberal dogmatist about this. I am, however, certain of this truth. Countries that have adopted a closed approach to the world economy have not been successful. That is not a path to economic growth and rising living standards. As a young man, as I said, I was optimistic about the prospects of Ujamaa socialism in Tanzania, but I'm afraid harsh experience taught me otherwise. Similarly, India's attempt at state industrial planning under Nehru and since simply did not work. What has been a success in India is the gradual opening of their economy to the outside world in the last 15 years. 300 million people have been lifted out of extreme poverty in a generation in India. Domestic liberalisation, reinforced by greater openness to the outside world, has put India on a sustainable growth path that offers that country's remaining 300 million poor a realistic hope for the future. For countries like India, it is greater south-south market opening that offers the greatest immediate development gain. South-south trade rather than north-south. On industrial tariffs, some of the greatest barriers are no longer between the north and the south. They are between the most advanced developing countries. Already growth in south-south trade is running at 11% a year. The interesting question is whether, because of the fear of China's burgeoning industrial power. The Indias and the Brazils of this world will be prepared to make the bold leap of faith towards further radical liberalisation. I hope they will, but there will be a note of caution that in doing so they will wonder whether they're not simply opening their markets to a rapidly expanding Chinese share of world exports. Developing countries cannot all be treated the same. There has to be, in fact, if not in name, differentiation. Some countries are better able to thrive in the global trading system than others. The weak, by definition, need more assistance, in other words, than the strong. There is a world of difference between Brazil and India on the one hand and Burkina Faso and Lesotho on the other. The more rapidly developing countries, if they wish to play a stronger global role, benefiting their new economic weight, cannot indefinitely shelter behind the high moral ground of a mythical united South, even those countries that still contain lots of poor people, as India does itself. In most cases, except for countries rich in natural resources, the goods that poor countries are most likely to be able to sell on world markets are agricultural produce and textiles and clothing. These old faithfuls remain the first steps on the ladder of successful economic development. Yet it is in these sectors of agriculture and textiles that the richer countries have tended to impose the highest barriers. We need to bring down these barriers, but at the same time, we need to recognize that doing so can be complex and it can be double-edged. Take the case of textiles. The final removal of all important quotas in January this year, after years of argument and gradual phasing out, was an important step forward for developing countries. It does, however, presage a world revolution in textile production. Chinese exports are expected to account for 50% of world production in 5 years' time. Now, developing countries like Bangladesh and Sri Lanka that have up till now benefited from quota access to European markets are therefore facing a new source of competition. Frankly, they find it terrifying, and I don't blame them. Were the removal of textile quotas to cause disruption and social mayhem in some of the world's poorest countries, I have not ruled out the introduction in the European Union of safeguard measures to help them. But I am extremely cautious about reimposing controls in a sector which has suffered from artificial distortions for so long, and where these distortions have in themselves damagingly widened the competitiveness gap between developing countries. Similarly, in agriculture, Europe has accepted the case for radical reform of the common agricultural policy. Last July, the EU offered to phase out all agricultural export subsidies as long as other developed countries follow suit. However, this will not be the unqualified bonus for developing countries that some believe. It's more complicated. Export subsidies presently depress food prices on world markets. Once they have gone, food prices will on balance rise, making life more difficult for net food importers, which include many African countries. But in the medium to longer term, this major reform will create the right incentives for developing countries to become successful agricultural exporters themselves, though it is more advanced countries like Brazil that will gain the immediate benefit of this liberalisation. We are also tackling within Europe artificial incentives for overproduction, at least to an extent. There was a time when our agricultural policy was founded on the principle of self-sufficiency for reasons of security as well as sentiment. Gradually, as subsidies for production have been curbed, indeed largely eliminated, the midterm review of the CAP decouples payments to farmers from production now for at least 70% of their output. Nobody can deny that there are still problems with our dairy and beef regimes in the CAP. Nor can we say with confidence at this stage what will be the impact on production of the CAP in the new member states. But as the CAP reforms that have been adopted largely eliminate the incentive to overproduce, Europe is opening up new market opportunities for agricultural exporters elsewhere in the world. My mantra then as Trade Commissioner is progressive market opening, helping countries at the same time to build the capacities to become full participants step by step in the global trading system. It is patronising and it's unrealistic to think that all we need to do is to organise more effective redistribution to the world's poor so that they can stay where they are, mostly as farmers eking out a living on the land, continuing to do what they have done for centuries. Of course, the modernisation of agriculture will remain central to many poor countries' development. In Africa, 70% of the population lives on the land, but agriculture accounts for only 30% of African GDP. The Kenyan Minister for Trade recently explained to me that the only way his country could hope to attain the Millennium Development Goals is by moving up the value chain in agriculture, selling higher value products overseas and raising agricultural productivity. We mustn't, through our policies, lock these countries into the past. We have to open up a different path into the future. And Kenya is starting to do this successfully. But the implication of this, as it was in the 18th and 19th century Britain, is a movement of population from the land and a process of industrialization in burgeoning cities. The only way to make poverty history is to allow developing countries to pursue this path of progressive change and industrialization. This makes the question of sustainability unavoidable. This is why the priority for climate change and the priority for Africa go together hand in hand. Progressive market opening is bound to cause problems of restructuring. I fully accept that, both within the European Union itself and within the wider world. Within the EU, we have social systems and welfare states that cushion the impact of economic change. At European level, we have the structural funds. Within the agricultural policy, increasingly, we've set aside large resources to help farmers retire or diversify. And a good thing, too, it's a better, more modern use of some of the resources locked into these policies. Developing countries, by contrast, because of their poverty, have few of these policy instruments available to them. One of the tasks ahead is to develop these policy tools for adjustment to help bring about that change, to equip countries and people to embrace progressive market opening in developing countries. And the EU is assisting with this on a limited basis where, under domestic and WTO pressure, we are being forced to reform our special preference regimes for bananas and sugar. We're putting together with these reforms action plans that help countries and people adjust. In January, I was in the Caribbean where some small countries face an economic tsunami. If the preferential quotas which have allowed them safe access to the EU markets are suddenly swept away, and we cannot allow that to happen. Europe has promised help with adjustment, and I'm determined that Europe will deliver. I'm also launching a programme with the ILO this year to help developing countries that liberalise cope better with the impact of liberalisation on employment and decent working standards. But this is relatively little by comparison with what is needed worldwide to ease the pain of a process of progressive market opening. Following on from these principles then, what further elements of our plan for 2005 do we need to put in place? First, let me give you my multilateral ambitions for the Doha round and the Hong Kong ministerial at the end of this year. One, delivering development through market access. Uppermost in my mind, we have an opportunity in the round to consolidate a major reform of the CAP and to make great strides towards open markets and away from trade distorting subsidies, as I've said. This is the most concrete contribution that developed and developing countries together can make. Progress depends, however, on the willingness of others to match what we in Europe have undertaken to do. This is not simply a matter of persuading the Americans and the Japanese to follow our example on agriculture, important as that is, and so far that commitment has not been made. It is also an issue of whether advanced developing countries are willing in turn to open their markets, not only to us, but also to the smaller developing countries by cutting their high tariff industrial tariffs and removing barriers to services. Two, action to convince the poorer developing countries that Doha offers them a good deal through the maximum use of special and differential treatment. Now, Europe, in this context, will demand practically nothing in this round from the poorest G90 countries in terms of market access, apart from some binding of tariffs. There must be real flexibility about the market opening commitments that these weaker developing countries are asked to enter into. Some should probably not be required to commit at all, in any sense. Special attention will have to be paid to the acute vulnerabilities of some countries. The most obvious example is some of the small island economies of the Caribbean, but there are other legitimate cases. In principle, the WTO recognizes the need for this, but progress is stalled by an argument over definitions. It is time for the definitional logjam within the WTO to be unlocked, and I've made a proposal to do so. Three, priority for the South-South agenda. The meaning of this is unambiguous. It requires the G20 group of developing countries, the emerging and relatively more advanced developing countries, to accept the necessity of an ambitious market access agenda for themselves in the DDA. And it also means that advanced developing countries need to be prepared to extend preferences to the weaker part of the WTO membership, as Brazil is starting to do. Difficult, but it has to be said and done. Four, a pro-development rules and standards agenda in this round. In my view, trade rules are inherently pro-development. Not everyone accepts that. It is my firm belief. Meeting international rules and standards helps countries achieve comparative advantage. Simpler trade procedures help exports by reducing the cost and time of doing business and allow governments of the poorest countries both to save money and increase revenue collection from duties. But it is no good giving countries lectures about how good rules are for them. They recognise in the main this already. The point is that they need our help to implement, to carry forward international rules and to meet international standards. There's no point in just standing there and gesticulating and telling people to implement the rules, again, if they don't have the means, the capacity to do so, and we can and must help with that. And that's why we've offered significant aid with technical assistance and capacity building in this respect. Where appropriate, we, the richer countries, have to be prepared to review rules and standards also in the light of their compatibility with development goals. We have to show some flexibility. Five, therefore, an open debate on rules exemptions. My intention is to widen the debate about the legitimacy of special treatment for poor countries in the implementation of WTO rules. Blanket exceptions and permanent carve-outs will be counterproductive. There's no point in giving people a sort of permanent passport out of any sense of obligation and the change that results from obligation if they simply end up isolating those countries from the world economy. They're no further forward in those circumstances. The logic of my position is to allow a breathing space for countries on a case-by-case basis until they are in a position to comply. Differential flexibility, therefore, not permanent opting out. And six, still in the Doha context, we must meet legitimate concerns on preference erosion. I want to put some fresh thinking into this. Everybody can help in this regard. Europe in activating better the preferences that will remain, other rich countries in extending new preferences. And I'm convinced that if the will is there, the problem can be resolved through enhanced trading opportunities and again through adjustment assistance. Now that's the developmental approach in Doha that I want to push forward and for which I'm arguing. But now second, let me outline what Europe can do on its own and bilaterally in cooperation with developing country partners. One, introduce a much stronger development focus into our economic partnership agreements. I have already announced my determination that in future EPAs will have a clearer development focus to them. They should no longer be conceived as trade agreements in the conventional sense where both sides are seeking mutual advantage. The EU is not pursuing an equal bargain in relation to our EPA partners amongst ACP countries. The purpose of EPAs is to promote regional integration and economic development. We are ready to see their trade barriers come down for EU goods and services gradually, but only when liberalisation is in the interest of those EPA partners themselves as part of their development agenda and their development progress. The key question is what progress the EPA countries are making in their capacity to trade, including with each other, as regional integration grows, and how we in Europe can help advance this. Two, new mechanisms for monitoring the effectiveness of development assistance within the EPAs. I've agreed with my colleagues in the Commission, particularly Louis Michel, the Development Commissioner, that we will introduce a new monitoring mechanism for the capacity building efforts we are making as part of these agreements. This monitoring mechanism will require the Commission to coordinate all the different efforts that Europe is making in relation to these countries. It may or may not surprise you to know that that coordination does not yet exist within the Commission perfectly. It will require an assessment whether the level of resource they are being offered is sufficient to meet their needs and whether our existing efforts are being well directed and effective in terms of building trade capacities. You cannot manage something and correct it if you don't measure it, and measuring it is what I want that monitoring mechanism to do. Three, better coordination of Europe's overall aid effort between the EU and our member states. My own instinct is that this coordination will need to go a lot further. If we are serious in Europe about making trade and aid work hand in hand, then member states will have to coordinate their own trade efforts much more closely with the trade policies we're pursuing bilaterally at EU level. There is still too much particularism in the way member states pursue their national overseas development objectives. We need more of a common approach if European aid is going to work effectively hand in hand with European trade opening measures. Four, greater transparency on Europe's trade and development record. The results of the monitoring of development progress under the EPAs should be public information. Far too much of it at the moment is kept behind closed doors. I propose that we should publish, therefore, an annual white paper to the European Parliament monitoring the take-up of our trade preferences to see whether tariff and quota-free access is actually proving effective and what therefore we might need to do to remedy it if it is not. Now that's the bilateral trade development developmental agenda. So third, let me set out lastly how I hope the decisions of the G8 can contribute to the success of our trade policy. The G8 has no powers of its own to negotiate deals on trade. What we can do, however, is to use the G8, and it's a coming meeting in Britain, in Gleneagles in July, to set a climate that will condition the success of the trade negotiations in the remainder of the year in the run-up to the Hong Kong ministerial. One, G8 agenda, one. The Everything But Arms initiative, which I've described, everything from LDC, least developed countries, coming into our markets, tariff-free, quota-free, the Everything But Arms initiative should be adopted by the United States, by Japan and Canada, in addition to the European Union. In terms of market access, a crucial gesture would be for the G8 to offer tariff and quota-free access to all G8 markets for LDC exports within a couple of years. Essentially, this means an extension, as I've said, of Everything But Arms to the US, Japan, and Canada. Two, support for the necessary reforms to rules of origin that will improve poor countries' abilities to make better use of their existing preferences. Now, rules of origin define the proportion of local content required in any good before it can obtain quota or tariff-free access. At the moment, we say to countries, you can come in, but if you have too much in the goods you're trying to get into our markets that come from outside your country, even neighbouring countries often, then we're going to bar your goods from coming into our markets. Now, too high a hurdle, too complicated in its operation. It's got to simplify. America and Europe set different rules, and their impact can be very restrictive. We need to converge. This needs to change, but in a way, therefore, that avoids the rules simply being circumvented by producers who are not entitled to preferential access. I mean, if, for example, you were to simplify or loosen these rules in a way that simply opened the way to Chinese inputs to LDC countries' goods, you would be opening more of your door to China, for example, which does not qualify for that preference. So it's complicated. I want Europe to bring forward proposals for new rules in the operation of rules of origin by the time of the Gleneagles G8 summit. And I want the neglected WTO work on global harmonisation of origin rules also to pick up speed and to support what we're proposing. Three, still on the G8 agenda, a push for greater international regulatory convergence of health and consumer standards for key developing country exports such as food and flowers. The cost of compliance with the standards of developed countries, including the EU, is high for poorer countries. Of course, the EU has to protect its citizens' health and well-being, and our standards are well designed to do this. But we must ensure that this does not have unintended, disproportionate side effects. EU sanitary and phytosanitary standards have not prevented us from becoming the world's largest market for food exports from developing countries. On that, we can take some pride. At the same time, though, developing countries raise these issues with me constantly, and the EU must listen to their concerns. And I will support collegiate debate within the Commission on this. The issues are at the heart of modern trade policy. Four, and lastly, on the G8 agenda, new funds for aid to help the poor trade more effectively and ease the social costs of adjustment. The G8 has an historic opportunity. It needs to determine how much additional finance it is prepared to pledge to help build poor countries' capacity to trade and enable them to cope with the costs of adjustment to liberalisation. We need new funding for investment in trade capacities that goes beyond the ability to meet the Millennium Development Goals target on malaria, tuberculosis and HIV/AIDS important though these are, there is an urgent need for the world's richest countries to establish a special trade adjustment fund. Existing efforts by the IMF and World Bank are good but inadequate. They can and should be extended. If the G8 is unwilling to make such a move, then it will fall to the European Union to consider what it can do on its own. The EU should consider its willingness to adopt the model of the International Financing Facility as an EU instrument of its own if others fail. Let me just say this, Howard, in conclusion. I hope I have put forward the outline, the skeleton of an action plan for progress that genuinely puts trade at the service of development. If it sounds complicated, it is because it is complicated, I'm afraid. Oftentimes with unforeseen consequences, oftentimes with short-term costs for longer-term gain. It is the price of acting in a sophisticated and differentiated way. The more sophisticated, the more you differentiate, the more complicated you become, but the more, hopefully, you reach the target that you want for the policies you want to employ. To use all our cooperative efforts in Europe, as well as the power of our trading muscle in order to make our multilateral trading system work at long last in the interests of the world's poor. That is the simple and compelling objective. Recognizing at the same time that only if we do this will it continue to operate in the interests of us, the developed world. I'm convinced, all in all, we can make a breakthrough for trade and development in 2005. By doing that, we can do our own bit, our own very important bit, to make poverty history. That is in itself, it would be no mean achievement for the European Union. And a good reason in itself, too, why every citizen of conscience should be prepared to give Europe a chance to pursue that objective. I hope you will, and I thank you for being so patient in listening to my remarks this evening.
Hi, my name's Elliot. I'm from London. I was just going to ask whether Mr. Mandelson would support one of the candidates to head the WTO from developing countries rather than Pascal Lamy, who is, I understand, quite unpopular with developing country negotiators.
That people don't make it into the North South.
Hi, thanks. My name's Tania. I'm from London. I've got a question. You mentioned the need for an EU database on technical assistance. On sanitary and phytosanitary regulations, there's already a standard and technical development facility which is supported by five international organisations, including the WTO. I know a number of members of the EU have supported that facility, and Canada have as well. Does the Commission plan to pledge any money towards that?
Anne Davison, I wanted to ask you about the gender issue. The NGOs have done some research which shows that vulnerable women can suffer from liberalisation and privatisation because of their lack of control over their circumstances, their lower mobility because of looking after children, and the fact that they may end up providing the services that would otherwise be provided by public service, and also the trafficking issue. And what you said about capacity building and action plans, I wondered if that takes account of the gender issue as well.
Well, it's one of the reasons why I'm keen to work with the IMF on labour standards and practices. The trade-off is no magic word to affect and to determine social conditions and labour standards in those countries with which we trade. Labour is one of those trade which the European Union is keen on introducing to the German government. Now, the great many of our partners who see these proposals oftentimes as interference, intrusion, as a way of keeping countries down by impeding them, by seeking to enforce social standards. Which they are unable to sustain. Now, I'm sympathetic to that point of view, but I think it would be quite wrong for us to lose sight of all those trade and issues. I know it's terribly difficult for the Doha. You know, in the context of the Doha round, the round is already so complicated. You know, it has five basic blocks of negotiation: agriculture, manufacturers, services, trade facilitation, anti-dumping and other rules, as well as the particular development package itself. And there are other areas of implementation, other areas of negotiation, which if we want an ambitious and balanced plan at the end of the day, we need to pursue in parallel. But the problem is this: it's not only that a number of these issues or these negotiating blocks that are seen as intrusions, interference, when we're trying to apply and enforce rules enshrined in the WTO. It's also that many countries simply find it difficult to negotiate such a large number is such that they turn around and they react and they say, we just cannot take on anything more. You know, it's difficult enough to find our way through, you know, agriculture before the trade quotas and without adding tariff reform on non-agricultural commodities. And so it goes on. And so there's a resistance to taking on a burden which for many seems excessive and intolerable. And that's part of the response that we get when we try to introduce these trade and additions to the world. However, it doesn't say that we lose no suffering. And I would just say this in conclusion to your original question. So much of what we seek to do in opening markets progressively over time, when I say over time, I mean for many of our least developed countries, quite a long time. But it requires not only progressive opening, progressive liberalisation, but I'm afraid progressive adjustment, progressive change, which does involve some change. Now, our responsibility, our practical as well as our moral obligation, is to help countries, to help people make that change. That's what we're trying to do, not least through our economic partnership agreements. But we have to be careful by what we seek to impose on the case in which we ask people to go in courts. Legally, we have to ask them to make progress. And sometimes for women, we're employed in ways, jobs, and sectors which puts them on the front line of economic change. So it would often be that they bear the greatest price.
Thank you very much for your talk, but I think a lot of people will think that it's just that, and that actually behind the rhetoric there's you're pursuing a very different agenda. And I'd just like to ask that it's all very well for you to say, tell other countries what to do, to tell Japan and China and India to do more for the poor, but what would you say to people who say that actually the agenda that you're pursuing at the EU is a business agenda, it's an agenda of increasing market access for EU corporations, especially in the industrial and service sectors, to developing countries. And despite your fine words and your co-option of the Make Poverty History campaign, actually what you're doing is not very helpful in those regards.
But you've described it accurately. The mic's now on. You've described it accurately. It is about creating business opportunities. It is about creating market access. It is about enabling developing countries to trade and become part of the international system when they have the capacity and the ability to do so, and that is the key point. There are many emerging, relatively advanced developing countries that want this only too much. Of course they want to embrace growing trade and growing business. Of course they want to create such opportunities. That's the way, that's the path to economic growth, to raise living standards in their countries. But for other more weak and vulnerable developing countries, no, we're not asking for access to their markets. No, we're not asking them to give anything in return in the Doha Round, as I made clear. And that's the point about differentiation. And sometimes developing countries don't like to be differentiated. They think it's some sort of fiendish, you know, divide and rule, Machiavellian plot by itinerant EU trade commissioners to sort of do them in and get round behind and create opportunities only for us in Europe. That's simply not the case. What we want to do is to grow everyone's markets. We want to grow everyone's prospects and chances to develop so that in time everyone can take part and benefit from an international trading system that is open and free. The alternative is to say, no, you don't become part of the international trading system. You remain closed. And remaining closed as an economy is a sentence to permanent imprisonment in backwardness and underdevelopment. Is that what we want? I don't think it is.
Woman, third row from the back there. Yeah, hand up. That's it.
Hello, my name is Hannah. I'm a second year economic history student here. I was wondering, do you believe that a fully free trading world is ever possible considering politics involved? And if it's not, do you think it's worth pursuing if inconsistent liberalisation policies in the North have negative consequences on the economies in the South?
Yes, but our job and our responsibility is to maximise the opportunities and minimise the problems. And the disbenefits, particularly the short-term ones, which are often painful, as I've said, and involve a lot of adjustment. And that's what makes our approach necessarily complex and difficult, because it is more sophisticated, because it does differentiate and attempt to tailor our policies to the particular needs of individual countries. Can you imagine anything more complex than that, to try and tailor policies in such a way? What you do, what you offer, the aid that you seek to deliver, the debt you seek to cancel, the bonds you seek to create in order to front load the debt, the aid that you want to give, to go hand in hand with that liberalisation and that trade opening. It's really difficult. And, you know, people... So I was being... I have a civil society dialogue now in what I do. It's the first time in anything I've ever done that I've sat down on a regular basis and sort of prostrated myself in front of a large number of people who, not all of whom want to tear me apart limb by limb, but there's a sort of goodish element. Anyway... And the other day we had one of these dialogues, and they were beating me with a great rod on my back about the inadequacies or the imperfections of our economic partnership agreements, even though none have yet been negotiated, none yet exist, and we're simply on the way to creating something that I hope will, you know, stand scrutiny. And I thought for one moment, it would have been easier not to have started in the first place on these economic partnership agreements. It would have been easier not to bother. It would have been easier not to try and tailor the delivery of aid and to make our aid and development efforts go hand in hand with what we're trying to do to foster regional integration, so that least developed countries have access to local sources, local markets, and local opportunities to trade, where they have some comparative advantage. You know, if I hadn't embarked on it, as it were, then I wouldn't have created the rod for my own back, which people are liberally setting about, you know, beating me up with. But if you don't make the effort and if you don't try, yes, you won't run into the criticism, but nor will you achieve what you want to create in this world.
One on the front row, who's been patient with his hand up right at the end there.
Thank you very much, Chair. It's John Hillary from War on Want, and also the Chair of the Trade Justice Movement Policy Committee. I actually just want to ask a very specific question, if I may, relating to your experience in Davos last weekend at the World Economic Forum, where the trade ministers had a sort of joint meeting behind closed doors. The reports from that were that Bob Zelick, the outgoing US trade representative, made quite a bold step and a bold initiative from the US to saying that developing countries within the WTO negotiations on agriculture and non-agricultural market access should not be required to open up through a formula the same as the developed countries on tariff reduction, but they should have different coefficients which would allow them a different pace. And indeed, in the non-agricultural market access negotiations, the ones on industrial and manufacturing goods, that they should not be compelled to undertake a mandatory sectoral initiative for harmonisation. Can you confirm that the EU won't block that initiative from the US, because that seems to us a very important step to take in substantiating genuine special and deferential treatment at the heart of those negotiations?
Well, it's not a matter of blocking a proposal. It wasn't a proposal as such, nor was it the first time it's been canvassed. Indeed, I've discussed it myself with Bob, as I have done with others at meetings since I came into my post. It is an interesting proposal, and it reflects the fact that there are a number of approaches that have been made trying to devise a formula that would serve differential tariff levels, very divergent levels of tariffs of developed and developing countries. The formulae that have been explored to date have not worked. I am I would be slightly concerned that we were, instead of bringing about a convergence and a compression over time of tariff levels, we were institutionalizing progressively diverging tariff levels, which seems to be not to serve the interests of the WTO as a whole and of developing countries in particular faithfully in the long term. But the fact is that in this whole area of non-agricultural market access, we have not made the progress. We haven't even put the rudiments, the building blocks in place to make the progress that we need to do. We have a lot of catching up to do if this round is going to be a balanced one. And certainly that is one idea amongst a number that we need to thrash out and consider, and that we certainly will.
One woman here, down.
Thank you. My name is Sheila Page. I wanted to ask you about the Fund for Trade and Social Adjustment, which you mentioned. Do you see this as being additional to aid and distributed in a different way from aid? And would the same thing apply to the proposed funding for sugar, which I believe you announced last week? Is that to be a separate fund, not part of the aid budget?
The
action plan.
The action plan on
yes.
To yeah. Yes. I mean the provision for funding our adjustment proposals within that action plan, which will go run alongside our reform of the sugar regime and the common agricultural policy, are separately funded within the EU's financial perspectives. There was a slight problem over a short hiatus between mid 2006 and the beginning of 2007, which led to an slightly unseemly squabble amongst a number of us as to who would pay for that short-term gap. But even that has been resolved now. So that funding for the Sugar Action Plan is in place, assuming, of course, that our member states actually agree a budget as a whole for the European Union. I look to the government representatives who are here in the audience, who are seeking at this very moment to constrain the EU's budget. I'm talking about the British government officials seeking to constrain the EU's budget in an unseemly way that might constrain our ability to do the things that we want to do. I'm looking at each and every one of them now. But, of course, that's a matter for healthy debate and negotiation, and nobody's taken fixed positions, have they?
Well, I have to say, Hans Eichel was sounding rather aggressive on this subject as well, not just our own government, I think.
Sorry, but yeah, I know a number of them are taking some rather inflexible early positions. But on the first, no, the discussion I had with IMF representatives was a separate initiative in addition to the existing mechanism that exists.
One down here, second row.
Thank you. My name is Maryam Al-Fodari, and I'm from Kuwait. And many people would argue that developing countries have a weak voice in international trade rounds, partly because the costs of participation are very high, settling disputes in Geneva, the WTO, or even participating in ministerial rounds is expensive, and it requires resources and expertise that developing countries might not have. So my question for you is, would you be in favor of actually channeling money, aid, and technical expertise towards helping developing countries negotiate international trade rules instead of merely implementing rules negotiated by others?
But that's why we fund the ACP office in Brussels, to enable them to represent their interests effectively. It's why we provide money for an office for the most vulnerable developing countries in the G90 group to negotiate and represent their interests at Geneva. And it's why, out of my budget, I'm putting up in hotels in Hong Kong representatives of the least developed countries so they can participate fully in our ministerial.
We'll take a couple more. I think one down here. Fine, thank you.
Cliff Stevenson from the law firm Mayer Brown Roe Moore. You made reference to the developing country concern with food safety rules. And several months ago, Commissioner Lamy, before leaving office, launched this initiative of perhaps a discussion about how you ensure that society's collective preferences aren't undermined by WTO rules, and the possibility that when WTO inconsistent protection may be permitted where it's reflecting society's concern, for example, with food safety issues or animal welfare or environmental issues. Is this a debate which the Commission will continue? Or
of course. It's an interesting and relevant philosophical debate.
One immediately behind.
Yeah. Eugene Quinn from BBC Radio. As part of the, as tied in with Britain becoming the presidency of the EU in July and the coming constitutional referendum, we're launching a campaign to harmonise humour across the European Union and put Britain back at the heart of Europe. I was just wondering if you could comment on whether you found as Britain's.
Did you say humour?
That's right.
I'm so sorry.
Paul Merton's launching our campaign. It's going to be a series of programmes on Radio 4. I was just wondering if you could comment on the nature of humour in Brussels, whether you found it. If you could tell us a joke, maybe.
Do you want the reply on or off the record? Off the record. Everyone prepared to oblige? Bill, you off? Alan, off? Off? I find it hilarious. There's so much to laugh at. So much to laugh about, and people to laugh with, because they're great people to work with.
Any more upstairs? Yeah, red shirt in the middle. We'll take two more because we're running over time already.
Hi, I'm Tom Sharman from ActionAid. Now, ActionAid and over 120 groups in the ACP and Europe have expressed concerns about anti-development economic partnership agreements, and these are set out in our Trade Traps report here. So, will you do two things? One, ask for a new negotiating mandate that withdraws the demands for reciprocal trade liberalisation and negotiations on investment, competition policy and public procurement. And two, start work on pro-development alternatives to EPAs as required by the Cotonou Partnership Agreement.
Well, there is nothing more asymmetrical than the basis of these negotiations and these agreements with ACP countries. As I say, we are looking for a very unequal bargain, indeed. So, please, your question is formed on a wrong premise, and I simply don't accept that they are anti-development. Again, the whole premise of them is that they are essentially instruments of development rather than classical, conventional free trade agreements of the kind that you would seek to negotiate between developed countries. It's not the nature of them at all. So please don't condemn before you've looked at them and properly understood what they're about, and please don't condemn them in advance of their being completed. Mind you, if you do condemn them now, you may be pleasantly surprised at the end of the day.
We'll have one final question. I'm sorry, it's going to be the woman, the second one in the white. Yes, yeah.
You mentioned your objectives for the G8 summit. Clearly, you want to get as much convergence among the G8 countries, and you mentioned that particularly Japan, Canada, and the U.S. need to get on board with the EU. So what are some of the main obstacles that the EU is going to face within the G8 summit, and also what are the techniques and kind of negotiation movements are you going to try to come up with to get those countries on the side so there will be convergence for these development agendas?
Well, I think in relation to Africa, one of the two priorities, British priorities, and I don't speak on behalf of Britain, obviously, and certainly not the British government, of which famously I'm not a member. of the two, do you take Africa? I think that the Commission for Africa, which the Prime Minister set up last year, and which will report in mid-March, will have a significant influence. I think it will create a climate of opinion. From what I know of the way the Commission is going, and obviously I haven't read its final report, I think it will be very compelling. I think it will focus government leaders. It will not ask them to do unreasonable or impossible things, but what it will expect them to do is to work together. I mean, as fellow members of G8, but also in partnership with African countries, taking forward NEPAD in a way which is not simply expensive from the G8's point of view, but is as importantly practical and focused and targeted on what we can do best to help them develop their own economies. So it's not just financial and it's not just rhetorical, and I think that's a major a step forward, and I think it'll have I think that if it's received well and reported properly, it could have a profound effect on the policy makers and the world leaders at G8 and on climate change. I don't know of any G8 country whose leader, whose prime minister or president has been more assiduous and more persuasive than Britain's prime minister in taking forward that agenda. And I don't know of anyone who could have and may yet move the United States government into a more benign position. And so I think we need to watch this space and hope for the best and hope things move forward.
Thank you. We're at 6:30, and I know that there are people around, and I see a few of them in the front rows, who start to twitch around 6:30 on a Friday if they haven't had a drink. And so I think we ought to wind up. Two thanks, though. Thanks to you for some very interesting questions, very succinctly put, which is not absolutely always the case in this hall. But particularly thanks to Peter for coming and for a fantastically interesting lecture and for responding to the questions so fully and for so long. We're really grateful that you came to the LSE to do this. Thank you.